What kinds of things do you think about when you're alone?
What I'm going to do next to stave off death.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Ben Montgomery about his book, The Man Who Walked Backward, An American Dreamer's Search for Meaning in the Great Depression. Don't go away. You wrote the true story of Plenty Wingo in the book titled The Man Who Walked Backward, An American Dreamer's Search for Meaning in the Great Depression. And I want to circle back to the art of being by oneself and the thoughts that one has. But I just want you to briefly describe this man and his mission.
He was a cafe owner in Abilene, Texas. 1931, he lost his business to the bank and his savings were drying up. And he decided to pursue fame and fortune by walking backward around the world.
And when you say walking backward, you really mean turning your back and walking heel first.
In reverse. He wore sunglasses with little rearview mirrors affixed to them so that he could see behind him. Yes, walking backward, backpedaling, going in retrograde across the earth.
And you begin the book by addressing the reader. You speak to the craft of the book, how you sought true facts and incorporated actual dialogue. But you also wrote the following. I've tried to tell a story of that dark period true as well. For that reason, and because we are occasionally mean to one another, you should be aware that this book depicts quite a bit of violence. Why do you have this warning, and did you know that you would have to have it when you started the book?
That was the last thing that I wrote. It felt like a dark book, and I didn't expect that going in. As it turns out, the early 30s, 31 in particular, was an incredibly violent year in American history. The year before, 331 police officers were killed in the line of duty, the most ever in a given calendar year in American history, before or since. The population in 1931 was half what it was today. I just found that this book was kind of full of bloodshed and perhaps not exactly what a reader might expect if they picked up a novel story about a fellow who is doing something as silly as trying to walk backward around the world.
Right. There's sort of this interesting juxtaposition of a guy who's just doing something, you know, for kicks, and then, you know, the Prohibition and the race relations and the Great Depression. You even make note that desk clerks in New York hotels, it was said, were asking guests if they would be using the room for sleeping or for jumping.
Yeah. This was, you know, everyone has tried to dispel as an urban legend the fact that the suicide rate went up after the stock market crashed in 29. And it's true, the numbers don't show a giant spike when you look at the numbers of fatalities, suicides in particular in New York City. But if you're reading the newspapers from that era, every day there's another suicide. The mayor of San Angelo, Texas, folded his suit coat and left it on the 8th-story window of the Hims building in downtown San Angelo, just one after the next. And not just that, but murder suicides. Men were killing their wives and their children, killing themselves because they couldn't deal with the pressures of that economic drop.
I want you to tell the story of Mopery in the Second Degree.
Sure. Plenty was walking out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he stopped by an officer of the law, a traffic cop. And the cop says, "Buddy, we're going to have to take you in." Plenty had been walking in reverse. "Well, is it illegal to walk in reverse around here?" And the officer said, "Yes, it is, and you're going to have to go upriver." He was very serious, and this frightened Plenty. He'd run into trouble with the police several times before this and would several times after. So he thought he was in for it. He thought this might be the end of his trip. And he asked the cop, what am I charged with? And the cop said, mopery in the second degree. And this sounded like an official charge to Pliny's ears. And he was his concern was increased. And before long, the gig was up, and the police officer buckled over laughing and said he had read about Pliny in the newspaper that morning and expected him to walk through, and he'd been on the lookout for him. So he's running him through the ringer, like many people did.
That's right. He has a number of encounters with police force, American and foreign even.
Yeah.
And so he manages to cross the Atlantic. Can you take us so he makes it from Abilene, Texas, to the East Coast and then gets on a ship?
He walks backward down the gangplank onto the SS Seattle Spirit. Sails kind of lucks into that deal. He's having a hard time getting passage without any money. He sails from Boston to Hamburg, Germany. Has a hilarious run-in with the crew chief on the ship, but eventually deports and hustles out of Hamburg and begins the long trek from Hamburg, Germany to, he's headed for Asia Minor via Istanbul. And he walked through Berlin in February of 1932, the very day that Adolf Hitler announced his candidacy for president. This was a time in Europe when tensions were high, nationalism was flaring, and he just happened to found himself like almost like Forrest Gump, like in the same environment, like these very significant historic events all the time, that being one of them.
Like just sitting here with you, I see there's a sort of twinkle in your eye, like, isn't this remarkable that this man backwards walked through these major historical moments?
Yeah, and just happenstance, you know? He bumped into a reporter for the Associated Press who had just spent several days interviewing Leon Trotsky, who had been isolated on an island. He'd been kicked out of Russia. Just one after the next. When he was in Texas, he crossed the Red River just before armed guards from Texas and Oklahoma had this serious showdown over a toll bridge that became known as the Red River War. No shots were ever fired, but, he was in close proximity to a slew of really fascinating facts that have kind of been forgotten about that era.
I want to stay with the historical context, but first, will you read a passage from his time in Europe?
I'd love to. So for the American portion of his trip, he was wearing a sign, sort of a sandwich board around his neck that said, around the world backward, printed in English. And when he arrived in Hamburg, Germany, he realized he needed to change the language of his sign. So he hired a man to paint a new sign. And this one said, Rückwärts rund um die Welt, around the world backward in German. So when he arrived in Osijek in Czechoslovakia, he was still wearing that sign, and as it turned out, the villagers hated Germans, and so they poured out of the walls of this castle and tried to kill him. He was rescued, explained who he was, and realized he needed to change the language yet again. He barely made it through the gate of the fortified village at the foot of the ancient Bohemian castle when he noticed that the peasants seemed to want to kill him. The signs were all there. They were angry and shouting. They were spitting in the dirt, and they were scuffling, holding one another back violently, the whole time staring through hard eyes at the backward stranger. Something was amiss. Pliny didn't know what, but he readied his fists just in case. The entrance to the village, 340 miles southeast of Hamburg, was flanked by stone walls, and inside the walls were rooms, and the deeper he progressed into the village, the more peasants poured out of the rooms and advanced toward him. Just before they reached Pliny, a uniformed constable appeared and ordered them to stop the commotion. He escorted Pliny into the little square, then into another stone room that housed a tavern of some sort. The bartender recognized that Pliny was speaking English, motioned for him to wait, then ducked out the back door. He returned accompanied by a man named Schultz, who spoke English and began translating for the constable. The constable informed Pliny that the peasants hated Germans, and they'd seen Pliny's sign, and they'd assumed he was German. They were all set to rough him up when the constable heard the commotion.
So you provide a lot of historical context. And I'm just wondering, is there any use in drawing parallels between then and now? Specifically, I'm thinking about hopelessness and listlessness among the American workforce.
I think there are tons of parallels between then and now. Interestingly, unemployment is like 4.5%, very low. Right. At the time, it was, you know, in 31, a quarter of the working population could not find a job. 8 million men were riding trains, or, you know, jumping trains, going crisscrossing the country looking for work. So in that sense, there, you know, it's not exactly parallel, but I think the level of unrest and divisiveness right now certainly mirrors the way it was in 31. And interestingly, I was just thinking about this morning, you know, on the front end of 1931, two interesting things happened. Number one, at a gathering of scientists in Cleveland, Ohio, a man named Mies presented for the first time ever photographic evidence that showed the curvature of the Earth. The very first time ever, he had used Eastman Kodak camera to photograph mountains 340 miles away from a high elevation in an airplane. And it showed people the Earth is actually round. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, in Argentina, some scientists try to recreate the French scientist Foucault's experiment, where they dangle from a 200-foot cord a big steel ball, and there's sand splayed beneath it, and the ball begins to swing, and it shows, without doubt, that the world is spinning. So the first couple of weeks in 1931, we have scientific evidence that the world is round and scientific evidence that the world is spinning. And almost 100 years later, people still refuse. There are some of us who refuse to believe either of those things, that the Earth is round and that it's spinning.
Right. And you write, with the whole world going backwards, maybe the only way to see it was to turn around. Was that what Pliny wrote that?
Yeah, that's sort of, you know, it took him some years to, I think, come up with an explanation, a decent fitting explanation, as silly as that sounded, as to why he did this. But yeah, he said, you know, I think someone had asked him why, and he said, well, it seemed like everything was going backward, and maybe the only way to see it was to turn around, which I think fits. You know, it says something about him. It makes zero sense when you parse it, when you unpackage that. It makes no sense whatsoever, but it represents, you know, this guy on this what amounted to a scary but novel quest for fame and fortune.
Right, and over the course of his journey, he walked 7,000 miles, wore out 12 pairs of shoes, and as you mentioned, he had these special glasses with side mirrors and wore like a dapper suit and had a cane.
Right.
Which sounds so uncomfortable.
Yeah, sure enough. And, you know, and this didn't work out for him. He thought he was going to get rich. He really believed that. And it did not work out that way when he returned to Abilene. Hesitate to give away too much. When he returned to Abilene, you know, he had $4 in his pocket. Yeah. His wife had divorced him on the road. He was gone 518 days in the hardest of the worst hard time. And, you know, and he had this vision of writing a book, someday getting rich, you know, because Edna Ferber could do it and so could he. And it just never came together for him.
It makes me think of the American dream, which was one of the more poignant parts of the book for me, is James Adams.
He coined in 1931, a book came out, An Epic of America. He wanted to write this sweeping history of the United States. And the first time that anybody had used that phrase, an American dream, and he said it over and over and over again throughout the book, but it was the idea that, you know, manifest destiny was over. The West had been settled, and the American dream no longer was expansion and exploration and pioneering. Instead, the American dream was settling into your community, getting involved, getting engaged in civics, and owning a home, you know, owning a slice of property. That became the American dream, and it was that very year when that idea was first posited.
And you write about that this simple phrase would plant itself so firmly in the American psyche that its definition would forever be simply inherited. And then I was reading in the back of your book that you have children. Yeah. And if we are to interrogate that now, what do you want your children to inherit
I want them to have an earth on which to live, like a steady daily existence.
First that isn't, and foremost.
Yeah, that isn't, isn't sort of violently assaulted by the forces of nature left and right. I want them to live without the fear of hurricanes and earthquakes and tornadoes and nuclear war. And I want to give them an earth that is sustainable at a bare minimum, a sustainable earth. And, that feels further and further out of my grasp each day.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Ben Montgomery about his book, The Man Who Walked Backward, An American Dreamer's Search for Meaning in the Great Depression. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You make a note at the beginning of the book that you came across plenty while researching unconventional pedestrians. What draws you to that interest?
I was working on my first book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, which came out in April of 2014. It tells the story of the first woman to, as we say, solo through hike the Appalachian Trail, walk from Georgia to Maine by herself and in one season. And I just went down a rabbit hole. My day, my life is full of like just going headfirst into rabbit holes. And so I'd gone deep into this rabbit hole into like pedestrianism of, the 1880s through like roughly the 1930s. So I was reading about like marathon walkers, which used to pack Madison Square Gardens. It was the sport of the day in the 1880s. And reading about people who had done wild pedestrian stunts. One guy walked 1 mile per hour for 1,000 hours, which is an incredible feat that's hard to even wrap my mind around. But I stumbled across this guy, and I want to say I had seen him mentioned. Plenty Wingo owns the world record for the longest backward walk, something like that. And so I began Googling, and he had a Wikipedia page that was only maybe two lines, mm-hmm. And explained bare minimum 1931. He had set off out of Fort Worth, Texas, ahead of backward. He made it all the way to Istanbul and then went back to the U.S. and made it from California to Fort Worth. And that was it. It said nothing more. It said nothing about why or who he was or what led him on this wild journey. So it, again, struck me as novel at the time. And I wasn't sure. I did not consider this to be a book. I had no ambition when I first stumbled across. It was just a little factoid, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I get haunted by these, unanswered questions. And this was one of them. And, I put it off and tried to ignore it. And, the years of this and what about that guy who walked backward? And so I returned to it and it turns out there wasn't a lot on the record until I started kicking rocks and making phone calls, and I connected with some of his family and had these great moments of serendipity where I got my hands on his diary that he kept in 31. And the more I learned about him and the more I learned about that era, the more certain I was that this was a story worth telling. And we went off to the races.
So this book made me think about my relationship to walking forwards and backwards. But I went to a really small non-traditional college and I took this course called walking. It was not an exercise course. It was a humanities class.
Wow.
And the final exam was a 3-day walk.
Wow.
You had to walk for 3 days. And I wanted to ask
what college?
Fairhaven College.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
What do you think the value of walking is?
Oh, I think... it's incredible. I think all of the best thinkers, writers, poets, musicians were walkers. There's a long history of Da Vinci, designed streets to protect pedestrians from car traffic. Woodsworth walked 100,000 miles in his lifetime. I think it was Beethoven walked 200 miles to listen to a classical pianist play, organist rather. Dickens was an insomniac and used to make himself tired by taking these long night walks. Of course, we all know Thoreau was a giant walker and published a piece in The Atlantic in 1858 called On Walking that said, interestingly, 1858, imagine this, they said, there will come a day when we're no longer allowed to roam over pleasure grounds, when the land is sectioned off by fencing, and when men of business are confined to the roads in their man traps. He's referring to the man automobile traps. In 1858, the man trap, and predicting those hellish days will come when you can't take a walk. And I come from Florida. I really appreciate the open spaces here that I can be out of my condo and on top of Mount Jumbo in like 20 minutes of huffing and puffing. You know, paying attention to the political advertising and how so much is focused on public land is a fascinating thing to witness. And I hope that people of Montana really appreciate that. This isn't the way it is in lots of places. I can't escape the city in Tampa, Florida. It's incredibly difficult. The second most deadly place for pedestrians in the country. So you've got a gift, and I appreciate that people really try to maintain it here.
Is there a connection for you between movement and writing? Do words come to you when you walk?
For sure, absolutely. Anytime I get stumped, I see it as an opportunity to go take a walk out of doors, to get outside. I often pace when I'm thinking. Even if I'm sort of inside, I'll walk back and forth across a room. If I'm having a telephone conversation, I'm always on foot, just walking back and forth. There's something linked to thought and motion. You know, they have studied dyslexia in children, and someone stumbled onto the idea that toddlers, before they learn to walk, they can tell if someone is going to be dyslexic by the connection with the movement on certain sides of the body. So if a knee and a hand go up together at the same time, you know, make that as the baby is crawling, that suggests that the brain function is not, you know, is abnormal. Mm-hmm. And so they've begun doing therapy in that regard, like trying to teach babies to cross crawl.
Right.
And this helps stimulate the brain. So there's some direct connection between the way our brains are wired and the way our bodies move. And that's on full display, I think, when we're walking. Besides that, just like testing yourself against the earth, like getting out of doors and seeing, you know, seeing where you stand in the world, in nature, gives us this opportunity to kind of take stock of things and measure our place in the world. You know, it's a powerful thing.
Mm. And it's different than running.
Totally different than running. I see people running, and I've run two marathons in my life. I'm pretty physically fit. I played football in college, but now I see people running, and I just want to say, slow down. What are you doing? Like, it's easier than that, you know?
Yeah.
And we do. We calibrate. Like, you know, there's this great Bill Bryson story where he's living in a small town in New England, Vermont, I think, and he witnesses a woman in an SUV driving round and round the gym looking for a parking spot. She finally finds a parking spot, and she goes into the gym and gets on the treadmill. And I forget if he asked her this question or if he just made the assumption or whatever, but she, I want to say she lived like half a mile away.
Yeah.
She got in the car to drive and then drove, you know, spent 15 minutes driving around the gym so that she could park and then go get on the treadmill and walk in one spot.
Man trap.
The man trap. Exactly. Exactly.
Have you spent time walking backwards?
Oh, for sure. I traced his route through Eastern Europe. So I had the very good fortune of taking my 13-year-old daughter to Hamburg. Well, we flew from, you know, into Paris for a couple of nights, but then Hamburg, Germany, and we you know, went by bike, car, train, plane, Hamburg to Istanbul. And every town that he walked through, I tried to spend at least a little time walking backward.
Yeah.
Especially spots where I knew he had gone down this sidewalk. Mm-hmm. In Rus, Bulgaria, he refers to the golden streets. And sure enough, there's a section of town that are paved by these yellow bricks, sort of, you know, very expensive, the result of a crazy king years ago. But I knew he had walked through this one section, and so, you know, I couldn't resist walking. If you think walking backward to camp is hard, you should try walking backward through like post-communist European cities in Bulgaria. The sidewalks are broken.
Right.
It's a challenge.
Yeah. Right. And I don't want to spoil the book, but he at one point he gets injured because, I mean, how could you not?
Right. Yeah. I'm surprised he didn't get injured more, actually,
right.
Because as good as he was, and they, you know, he trained for 6 months silently without telling anybody what he was doing. Before he set out. So he had some practice and he had the mirrors on his glasses, but still, you know, this is the image that sticks in everyone's mind, it seems, but they say that he walked so many miles backward that his calves had moved around onto his shins like grapefruits. That's kind of a gross image to me, you know, but it says a little bit about his dedication.
Right.
But he got really good at it, you know? So the one injury, while surprising, you know.
It could happen if you're walking forwards anyways.
Yes, yeah, for sure, and does.
I want to land on the meaning of this.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of one of the chapters, you ask, what's a man to do when there's nothing left to be done, when his spirit stirs, when there's no geographical void to receive the fruits of all his energy, what then? How do you answer that?
Well, you know, this was an era in which he thought everything, I mean, everyone thought everything had been done. A guy had rolling a steel hoop from Texas to New York City. Charles Lindbergh had flown across the Atlantic from New York to Paris. A man had pushed a peanut up Pike's Peak with his nose. As they say, every flagpole had a flagpole sitter atop it. And yet Pliny found something original and something unique. And maybe that's how you answer that question. In these moments when you think there's nothing left, there's no way to stand apart, it's an opportunity to examine all of our options and try to be individual. He did it, 31. You know, people continue to do it. And as long as we have the gift of hanging around on this flawed, fantastic planet, I think we should keep waking up and keep looking for those opportunities.
Ben Montgomery is a former reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and a Pulitzer Prize finalist. In the autumn of 2018, he lived in Missoula, Montana, where he was a visiting Polner professor for the University of Montana School of Journalism. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bo Baker, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.